This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We were in conversation with the new school librarian of the year and trying to get an understanding of why reading amongst youngsters is in the decline. The book lady Malar from Booktopia has some theories and loved your suggestions about what your kids are reading. So if you need some suggestions, you're in the right place. Turning our attentions to health, speaking to Mohammed, his four-month-old baby girl has been diagnosed with a life-threatening condition. A genetic disorder. There is hope. There is an injection, but it costs 8 million dirhams. Talking to him about that predicament and getting a deeper understanding of genetic diseases as well with one of Dubai's most booked up doctors, Dr. George of Genesis Clinic. And it was all about capital cities with a world record holder, a 10-year-old who are putting me through my paces about my knowledge. And, well, let's just say it didn't turn out so well. Speaking of failure, why is it so important to teach our kids how to fail well? What is a growth mindset? And if they make mistakes, could it be preparing them for a very successful future? That's all here and more.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about books and literature and a passion for reading, which unfortunately a lot of young people simply don't have these days. Our kids are reading less and it's pretty worrying. Last year in the UK, it was reported the number of children and young people who read every day and the percentage of those who read for pleasure has declined, according to the National Literacy Trust for World Book Day. And based on data, just over a quarter of those aged 8 to 18 read every day, compared to 43% in 2015. Joining us now, we are joined by Malar, the book lady, founder of Booktopia. They've got two stores, and she's going to be explaining a little a bit more. I mean, I feel like, Malar, you might have a slightly kind of skew-iffy view on this, because people that come into your stores are probably already book lovers and avid readers. But how do those stats make you feel?
I'm afraid the stats are true. And we have to admit the numbers, the number of children who are reading are declining. It's not surprising, though. But yes, over the COVID time, all of us are kind of mentally drained and the stimulation to go pick up a book has drastically reduced. And yes, as you said, people who come to the stores are book lovers, so they come there to buy. But even there, I see a pattern where you need to suggest books and a small stimulation is needed.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think back to when I was a child, 30 years ago, I had four TV channels and, and no internet. There wasn't that much competing for my attention, really. What impact do you think modern life has had on our appetite for books?
As you rightly mentioned, there's a lot of distractions and, you know, we just have... it's easy, right? You give a child a gadget, the colors are there, the music is there, the sounds there, there's immediate gratification. You just take there. You don't have to get into a zone of reading a book, getting into the feel that we had. Mm-hmm. And also, I feel children do not have the time, Helen. If you see, children have become more busy than most of us. They just have school, classes, this and that. They just do not have the time to sit and read for leisure or read for pleasure.
Oh, it makes me so sad, but I completely understand why, as you say, there's some very solid reasons behind that. But I mean, we'd love to turn it around. Can you give us some reasons why we should? What are some of the benefits of reading to our kids at a young age and children reading into their childhood?
As we know, reading gives them... forget, I'm not going to talk about vocabulary and communication skills. We know that and we've established that already. But there's one fact... and a strong reason that I've been trying to advocate through my research and my talks is now that we're all cocooned in our houses with just our families, it's just the three or four of us, and we have families seeing family through Zoom. But books give you direct access to life stories to people across the world. People who are like us, people who are not like us, people who could be different, people with a disability, people with a different religion, different language and different color. Now, those are life lessons that the COVID has prevented children having. A normal conversation that, you know, you go to a park and you there's a small spat between two children, they fall down, they make up and they go back and play again. We are losing that. Mm-hmm. But that can happen or a child can be exposed to that in a book. They can read a story about it. So now parents have to understand reading books now for pleasure and introducing books now during the pandemic is really important and vital to the children to understand life that they are missing actually.
We know that you can escape in a book. You can escape to foreign countries. You can be taken off to mystical lands and really explore that imagination. And as you said before, it's easy to pick up a device, but it's passive. You're sitting there as a consumer. There's no stretch of what could this character look like or sound like. And that's pretty amazing, to be honest, to be able to explore your imagination. Lots of people getting in touch sharing what their kids are reading right now. A 10-year-old loving Big Nate. Ibrahim saying, my 9-year-old's into Harry Potter. He's on book 4 already and reads every day. Trying to get him into other books, though, which he's not too keen on at the moment. Sneals said, my 8-year-old is reading Q by Omi. I didn't know this. A fantastic, easy read of heroes, witches, giants and talking leopards. If that's not imagination, I don't know what is. So in terms of trends you're seeing in Stormalar, what are some of the books that you're seeing people gravitate towards? What's doing well?
The best sellers, of course, do well. But I've also seen an increase in choosing books that are fantasy, that have fictional characters, as you said, which is like Narnia. Of course, Harry Potter is still the best seller. But we've seen a lot. And also people have started going to Enid Blyton again. I've seen a lot of young children from the age of, maybe if it's because the parents are reading to the children, but 5 years to 8 years, I'm seeing children come back and ask for Amelia Jane, The Folk of the Faraway Tree, the Wishing series. But the preteens and teens are gravitating towards Percy Jackson, Magnus Chase, all those fictional heroes, superheroes, and of course the comics.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that's a kind of a real diversion. In some camps, you've got people who are going towards basically like the comfort food of books, like the nostalgia, yes, the countryside, the purity, the wholesome. Yeah. And the other, it's that complete escapism. And I know an awful lot of people want to escape what's going on right now.
That's what it shows, right? It shows different tangents of children trying to escape from where they are into something else. It just shows us that that's what they want to do. They're just tired of all of this.
I get it. I get it. Mala, thank you so much for being with us. As I said, two stores of Booktopia to be explored, plus online as well. We are
family matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking kids and reading. What is your little one, from toddler through to teen, really enjoying right now? Is there a book that you're getting a bit sick of reading at bedtime, or one that they cannot stop talking about? My current favourite with my little ones is Ross Collins' There's a Bear on My Chair. I just find it really, really entertaining. Our kids are apparently reading less. It's on a decline in many parts of the world. Actually, here in the UAE, we have seen a slight increase amongst young readers, but we still have a long way to go. Many of you getting in touch with with questions about how to get kids into reading, to fall in love with it. So putting those to Alison K. Williams. She's an author. She offers virtual and travel writing retreats and writing workshops as well. It's so lovely, Alison, to hear what people are reading to their kids and what they're enjoying as well. What were some of your favourites as a child?
You know, I really loved the Eloise books by Hilary Knight and Kay Thompson, and I was always mystified that they were shelved in the adult section, because they're picture books, but they're very sort of sharp-edged picture books. And of course, I loved the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books. I read all of the Nancy Drew books, all of those classic American ones. And I still read a lot of what we call middle grade, so grades 3 through 5, about ages 8 through 12. And I still read a lot of young adult as well, because it's what I love to write. So you've got to keep up with what everybody else is reading.
Do you know what? When I think about when I fell in love with reading, it probably was around that age 10, 11. And it was through books like, your Judy Blooms, your Paula Danzigers, your Nancy Drews, your R.L. Steins and your Babysitter's Club, Sweet Valley High. And some of them, there weren't any big life lessons, but in some of them there really were, about growing up and friendship and love, even young teenage love. And it kind of breaks my heart that kids aren't reading as much, to be honest. And I completely get it, though, Mala talking there about the number of distractions. You know, as I said, there was nothing on TV, and I was living in the middle of the countryside in the winter, not much to do, funnily enough. So,
and no screens. I mean, none. I remember when I was a kid, I used to sneak a book out to dinner with the adults. Like if we were going to dinner with my grandmother's house, you know, I could stay at the table and then ask politely to be excused and go read while the grown-ups had grown-up conversation. But even in a restaurant with my parents, I would sometimes sneak a book in so that if the table got, you know, grown-up-y, I could read my book quietly under the table. And now I go into a restaurant and I see little children and there's a screen in front of them at the table. And it's like, well, you know, A, when are they going to learn to have conversation and table manners and, you know, hang out with grown-ups? And B, I think there's value in letting kids be bored and letting their imagination direct them, whether that's to a book, to a sport, to thinking about school, to making up stories in their head. And I think we've really done our children a disservice by determining that they shall never be bored.
Mine get plenty bored. What I would say is sometimes a screen at a table can allow you to have a bite to eat. So everything in moderation. We've had a number of messages and questions for you, Alison. One saying we're reading no books, but a magazine. 9-year-old loves to read Kick, the football magazine, which leads me on to a question here about, well, I've had a number of these going, Charles doesn't like to read at all. What are some of the ways we can help our kids fall in love with reading when we are really competing with so many different distractions?
Well, I'd say the first thing is ask your librarian, because librarians are absolute wizards for knowing books for reluctant readers, books that kids who aren't really into reading might get into. And something that's very popular right now for both young books and young adult books is books that are written in verse. Like they're not necessarily rhyming poetry, but they are written in short, evocative language. There's a lot of white space on the page. They're a relatively fast read. And when you get to the end, you feel like you've accomplished something, you know, which you have. You've read a whole book. I would also say, too, graphic novels are a huge genre. It's really exploded, whether that's traditional like manga, Japanese comics that are, you know, more video game kind of oriented. But there's also some very lovely graphic novels now that are the kind of book that normally would have been written in words. So, you know, a Judy Blume type book, but written as a graphic novel. And those are a great door in for reluctant readers, as well as being a wonderful art form in themselves.
I love that point about that sense of accomplishment, because even now, if I pick up a whacking great brick of a book, it can feel a bit daunting. So I can only imagine what kids, when they're still grappling with certain words or styles of writing, might feel. Pooja's going in chat saying, my child is 5 and is behind the rest of his class when it comes to reading and comprehension. He seems really discouraged. How can I encourage him to keep reading no matter how slow his progress? Thanks for that, Pooja. I think that's a challenge a lot of parents are facing right now.
And, you know, I think that's where you mentioned earlier, you know, the book you get tired of reading. But I think that's where repetitive reading with the parent and child really serves a purpose. Because if you're reading that book every night for 5 or 6 nights in a row with your kid, they're going to start recognizing words, and they're going to start in a low pressure environment. There's no grade, there's no teacher, there's no audience. Mm-hmm. There's just mummy going, do you remember what this word is? Do you remember what the bear does next? And that kind of engaged, active reading with parent and child, not a huge long time, like 10, 15 minutes before bedtime, maybe after a meal. That's a really low pressure way to get them excited about stories. The other thing I'd say is if parents can retell stories that they remember, whether that's fairy stories from their home culture, traditional stories from their religion, stories that are even like family history type stories, getting kids just interested in the idea of humans tell stories to one another, and that's part of how we make sense of the world. I think that's a really great way to get kids engaged in wanting to know more, and then books becomes one of the ways to find out more.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Rahul, for this message saying, I gave my daughter a word search book. She absolutely loves it. Also a way to learn about new words, so when she comes across them in a book, she knows what they mean. Love that. Shivangi's been in touch with my 11-year-old who's reading the Da Vinci Code. I think I was about 25 when I read that. That's amazing. And the message here saying, my son, who's now 16 years old, used to read voraciously up until 2 years ago. This summer, I told him I'd like to see him read again. Anything that interests him. To bribe him, I said, reward him with money at the end of the month. It might not be the best solution, but it's worth a try. Hey, if it gets his nose in the book, you never know. He might just fall back in love. Alison, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure to hear someone talking with such passion about reading and storytelling. We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What are your kids reading? It could be little ones that you're reading to at bedtime. It could be teens and you can't get their nose out of a book. Loving your recommendations, if anything, because that's exactly what we're talking about. The books that have really captured your kids' attention. We've got Wasik Nabil's been in touch saying, I'm 13 and I'm reading Roald Dahl, The Twits, one of my absolute favourites. And while they haven't made it into a movie yet, I do not know. Thank you, Thaminda, saying, my kids read The Tale of Troy. Their brothers, one is 10, the other is 8. They are stuck in it. And no name on this one, but thank you so much for your suggestion, saying, my son is 9 years old and he's currently reading the Percy Jackson Olympians. A lot of words send us to Google, but it makes it both a pleasure and a learning experience. And if you need some recommendations, well, you're in the right place, because we're speaking to someone now who's inspiring children to fall in love with reading against all odds. When I say against all odds, I mean when you're competing with games, basically. Recently honoured as the 2021 School Librarian of the Year by the Emirates Literature Foundation, Sonia Alhawi of Aspen Heights British School in our nation's capital is joining us on the line. Sonia, congratulations.
Thank you. Hello, Helen. How are you?
I am good. I am so honoured to be speaking with you. I'm really keen to pick your brains because we know what a challenging year it has been for educators such as yourself. And this kind of accolade, and for something that's really meaningful, you know, helping kids fall in love with reading, to guide them towards books that they might not have thought of, or something that maybe a book for the very first time. So massive congratulations. How did you become a school librarian? How did it all start?
Since I was working in Jordan, I have 13 years experience now, and I love my job so much.
What is it about it that gets you going into the school every morning with a smile?
Yeah, sure.
What do you love about it?
You know, I'm so happy when I put smiles on the children's faces. And as you see, this year was full of challenges, like library closing and social distancing, sanitizing the book. So it was full of challenges. But despite all the challenges, I could manage to put the books on the hands of reader and promote love of reading across Aspen High School.
Now, we mentioned earlier that reading amongst kids is on the decline, and obviously it didn't help that the pandemic shut physical schools, certainly for a time here in Dubai, but in Abu Dhabi, you know, still yet to resume classroom learning. So it's so sad to think of libraries and schools that have been empty, books gathering dust, them not kind of fulfilling their purpose in life. How are you encouraging kids to pick up a book and really escape during distance learning?
Yeah, as you know, reading is very important for children. And there is a proverb say that learning in childhood is like engraving on stone. So this is my responsibility as a school librarian, is to promote love of reading among the children by doing fun and exciting reading activities, such as reading a story using puppet, for example, puppet theater for nursery. And provide like interesting materials like story facts, nice book, suits their interest. And what else? Doing reading competition, writing competition. Now, most of the students are using their devices, iPads, so they can just use like book creator application to create their own books, for example. And there is also a platform Read Theory, Picatel. It's free and it's easy to access for the parents as well, not only for the children. There is Oxford Owl also, there is Arabic platforms. So children can read lots of e-books.
I think that's a really good point. It's not about one or other. It's about the love of reading and the love of storytelling. And, you know, I think about libraries in kind of in my time, and it was very much used as a resource, as a reference. Even at university, you know, the internet was only just coming in. Now we know that, you know, that kind of sense of curiosity is being satisfied by Google. Kids can just simply, you know, put that question rather than trying to find the book, walk to the book, open the book, find the page. But there's still so much value in physical books and in libraries. What do you think the secret to a good library is when you think about layout or making it inviting? What do you think could make something really special?
I think it's to find like good ebook suitable with their age and suitable with their interests. So during the platforms maybe or ebook, but you know, I think the children, they love to read them, the paper book, the hard copy, rather than the ebook or online ebook. Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes the library is closed, I think. And even if the library are open, I think also the parents, maybe they are afraid of sending their children to the public libraries, for example.
And now we know, obviously, going back in Abu Dhabi, there's going to be kids back in the classrooms. There's going to be children coming through to the library. Now, this is going to be a very difficult question, so I apologise. But is there a book in the library that is your favourite, that you watch children open and discover and it always makes you smile?
All the children books, especially for the nursery, all the children books, because it's like they have like a big picture book. So they love to read the books about dinosaurs, the book about animals. They make me very happy. And especially when we make like a mask or puppet and the children are sharing the story and retell the story wearing this mask and this puppet.
Sonia, huge congratulations again on being crowned School Librarian of the Year. Incredible accomplishment, and I'm sure you're really excited to see those little faces again in real life.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking children's health today, and earlier I was speaking to Mohammed, an Abu Dhabi resident whose four-month-old baby girl Malak was recently diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy. It's a genetic disorder characterised by weakness and wasting in muscles used for movement. There is hope, a life-saving injection, but it cost 8 million dirhams. I asked him, how is she doing today?
Malak, now she's fine and she's at home with us and everything is well. But as I mentioned before, as with even the medical reports which I have shared, Malak currently is not moving as a normal baby. As we can see, there is a lot of struggling. She's struggling by moving her arms and legs, and the legs is totally not moving. It was our second experience, because we had an issue before, as you highlighted, and I said also about our son Abdurrahman, who passed away in 2018. Currently, we are trying, all our best to provide the injection. As you know, the injection is too costly. It's high. I cannot afford even such amount, which is equal to 8 million dirham. Malak, now, as I said, she's normal, and just we noticed that her leg, it's not moving like a normal child. So this would, that was, the first indication, we felt she's abnormal or something. So we consulted the doctor, and the doctor informed us to go for some tests, which is required to be done here in Dubai. We done all the necessary tests, and unfortunately it was the cause.
It sounds like, Mohammed, you knew as parents that something wasn't right, and you were pushing for those tests after being told a few times that everything was so-called normal. You obviously had experience of this with your son, and I'm so proud of you that you pushed for the diagnosis, that you knew that parental instinct that baby Malak, would need some extra help. What was it like getting that diagnosis?
It was, even the doctor was not able to find out what is her exactly, what is her issue, because as I said, I had an experience before, so that made me more worried about. Even when I took her to the doctors here and there, so they all of them, I just visited four doctors, and they said she's normal, and she's a normal active baby, and no need to worry, and no need to think over thinking about her. She's very perfect. Still, I was having, to be honest, I was having that fear factor about, what if she's having a similar issue. So I need to make sure like I have that peace of mind, you know, like by consulting another doctor. I visited another hospital where the doctor was ready like to help us to do such a test, which is required to be done. We done the test, and as I said, like we found it in very early stage. Like usually the people, they will try, they will find out after completing 6 months or 8 months, we were able to get the information or the detailed report about the case within 3 weeks' time. That will help us, you know, to find a better way of giving treatment or just to work out how you can to arrange the medication. But, you know, it's the cure, it's about one injection only, and that injection will be given for one time only.
It cost 8 million dirhams for this injection. Why is it so expensive? What do you know about it, Mohammed?
The injection is expensive because, as I said, like it's a newly medicine, like the insulin is recently like started in the market, and as I know, like the company or that manufacturer, what they spent a lot of, you know, money in the past, let's say how many, like 30 or 40 years ago, on the research and just to find out a cure for such diagnosis. That's the reason we can say like the cure is expensive. And I don't know what I have to say about it. You know, it's 8 million. It's the amount, even if I spend my whole life saving, or if I will not be able to arrange such, you know, amount, you know, as an individual, I will not be able to arrange such amount.
It's an inconceivable amount. You know, we talk about... It's almost abstract in how expensive it is. It doesn't feel attainable in any shape or form. So I can't begin to imagine what you and your wife are dealing with right now, trying to make this happen. And as I said earlier, you're still unfortunately in debt from your son's illness. Your insurance obviously covered a small amount of that, but it's still a big part of your day to day now, and trying to pay back that cost. What have the doctors said about Malak and what will happen if you don't get this injection? What is the expectation?
Yes, as I said now, the cure should be given as soon as possible and in early stage. Now the cure will be given, or the company of the medicine, they are just giving instruction that the medicine should be used maximum at the age of 2. The baby will turn like 2 years old. It will be hard to get the medicine. You will not get that whatever the expected result, what is, should be there. The doctor, I'm aware about what is going to be happen in the very late stage, because as I said, I had a similar experience before, and that's the reason, you know, today as a father, just I'm working hard, and I'm working day and night just to raise awareness like about Malak's case. From my point of view, as I said now, before, maybe it was a little bit hard for me because the medication was not here. Like it was, the medicine was not available here in UAE. It was abroad. So that was the main issue for me, just to think of traveling or something. It was impossible at that time for me. Now, since the injection is already available here in Dubai, so what we can, what we have to do, we have only thing just to think about the funds, how to raise the funds. And, you know, here I approach like most of the charity organization here in UAE. So I'm just filling whatever the requirements, the documents, the ask, the medical information.
I think this is the difference between Malak and your son, who did pass away, that this time there is hope, but there is also a huge obstacle.
The cure, which is now available in the market, it was under study at that time. It was for the clinical trial at that time. Even I got an invitation like for just they invite me just to call like Abdurrahman abroad out to the US. So at that time, you know, since he was connected to the ventilator support or the support tools, I was, you know, not able to travel with him. And the final stage, they said, since like the child is connected to the just getting the ventilator support, it won't be possible even to do such studies on him. All the doors was blocked, you know, in my face, and I tell for Malak, you know, I feel that the doors are closed, but we don't know like which door is going to be open.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday. We're talking children's health, education and parenting. And earlier today, I was in conversation with Mohammed from Abu Dhabi. Him and his wife had a little girl, Malik, 4 months ago, and she was recently diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy and will need an injection. It will save her life, but it costs 8 million dirhams. His son was diagnosed with the same condition a few years ago, but he tragically passed away. So now Mohammed and his family are fighting to save Malik and climbing a significant uphill battle to raise those much-needed funds.
Feeling really helpless. Like I'm just, you know, trying, you know, even if I will work for another, let's say, 20 years or 50 years, I want people to arrange such amount. And you know that amount even cannot be paid in installment or something. I don't know where to go, how to go, what to do. And like, inshallah, she can take her chance to get the cure in the coming days.
I think all we can do is just keep talking and make sure no one forgets. So thank you again. Thank you. I really, really do appreciate your honesty and vulnerability in talking about it. So
I
really am thinking of you. And please keep us posted. We'll share the Instagram account as well so people can follow your progress there as well.
Please. We can keep on sharing and hashtagging that profile where it will reach, because I do believe I have a big fit now. The medication or the health is number one here in UAE. I believe what the power of media can do.
I do too. It can do amazing things. I'll share you on my personal Instagram as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Helen. Thank
All right. Take care, Mohammed. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless you.
Mohammed there sharing his struggles upon that diagnosis of his baby girl.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking children's health today and hearing earlier from the father of baby Malik. So important to raise this issue because there could be conditions facing you and your family that you might not even be aware of. In conversation now with Dr. George of Genesis Clinic. He's a consultant in obstetrics and gynecology and fetal medicine and maternal medicine as well. So I wanted, if it's all right with you, doctor, to get your medical take on what spinal muscular atrophy is. Can you explain it to us lay people, us who haven't been through, you know, perhaps a decade of medical training?
Helen, so nice to be on air again with you. And it's actually a very important matter that you're bringing up. Spinal muscular atrophy is one of the common neuromuscular disorders. What does this mean? It affects our nerves, and by deteriorating nerves, we lose control of our muscles, our skeletal muscles. What is not known is that it is extremely common. Well, the actual disease is not so common. We have about 1 in 10,000. But this is a genetic disease that we carry in our system. And it is in that group of genetic diseases that are called autosomal recessive, meaning that you can have one non-functional gene and be absolutely fine without any problems. But if your partner has the same problem, then there is about 1 in 4 chances of your baby to be affected, basically picking up the wrong gene from both you and your partner and having the full-blown disease.
And with that disease, yeah. Dr. George, can I ask you how does it present, you know, in a baby or an infant? What would a parent notice?
Presentation is quite variable with spinal muscular atrophy. And in general, today you have like 4 different types, starting from 0 to 3, so type 0, type 1, type 2, type 3. Type 0 and type 1 is the one that you see either towards the end of the pregnancy or shortly after birth. So these are the babies that are, or the children that are most severely affected. And till recently, these little ones will not make it more than the second year of their life. Why? Because as the muscles basically don't function properly, eventually these little ones cannot breathe. So it affects not only the skeletal muscles that will hold your head and get you to walk, but it will affect the breathing muscles, so you cannot sustain your breathing. Type 2 and type 3 are slightly less serious, but still these little ones will not be able to sit by the or be independent moving around by the age of teenage years, and this is about 20% of cases. And then this becomes kind of this late onset or juvenile form as we go on type 3 and type 4. So it has a variable presentation, and the reasoning for that is that although we say it's a gene that is either there or not there, we can have different variations on the severity of the part that is due to produce the specific protein. So each one of us can present the disease at different forms.
Dr. George, we've just been speaking to Mohammed, who is the father of baby Malik. She's just 4 months old, and thankfully her diagnosis was quick because of a new genome centre here in Dubai. But the treatment is tricky and very expensive, 8 million dirhams for an injection. Can you tell us, what does that injection do and how will it help baby Malik?
Till now, in general, treatment used to be just supportive and was not particularly effective. However, with recent genetic interventions, there are a number of what they called disease-modifying treatments. So I don't know which is the one that the specific baby is having, but the one of the most recent one, effectively, everybody knows through coronavirus, the use of adenovirus vectors, and basically what they do, they introduce a functioning gene to this baby to try and improve the condition. Now, it's not a complete fix, but it improves dramatically, and in a recent study, we're not talking about large numbers, we're talking about 15 or 20 little ones. At a time that you would have lost most of them, which is the 2 years, all of them were alive, and a number of them were actually doing very well, hitting their motor milestones. So things are changing as genetics are changing. You hear about CRISP, you hear about introducing genes or functioning genes to children with genetic problems. And this is where medicine is rapidly going to.
We've been talking a lot about health, obviously, over the last couple of weeks with Arab Health being in town. And it seems like the future is very much about wellness rather than treating sickness, and prevention being the watchword, and even personalised medication. Can I ask, when it comes to the importance of genetic testing, who needs to do it, Dr. George, to avoid situations such as this?
Well, there are two different types of testing. I suspect this was picked up either by babies' symptoms or in most genetic screening of the baby after birth. The traditional heel prick screening actually involves screening for SMA. Having said that, it is for a while now recommendation of the American College to discuss and offer carrier screening to the parents before pregnancy or in early stages of pregnancy. So there are two conditions, three, if we put cystic fibrosis, spinal muscular atrophy, and Fragile X, that the American College is talking or recommending for the clinicians to have a chat with the parents in early stages about screening to whether they are carriers. The fourth has to do with hemoglobinopathies like sickle cell and thalassemia, which are normally tested much easier with a blood test in the first trimester. Now, why is this important? It is important because for spinal muscular atrophy, depending on the population, the frequency of one of us carrying the gene is anywhere up to 1 in 60 to 1 in 90. It varies from different population, but what I'm trying to point out, that is not so rare. And especially when you're picking up genes from a smaller group of people, kind of relatives, people that come from areas that you might not be in a direct cousin, but you know, if you go 2-3 generations back, you probably are related. These tests are even more important. We are families.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good to have you with us this Sunday afternoon. We're talking children's health today in conversation with Dr. George of Genesis Clinic, one of Dubai's most in-demand doctors when it comes to fetal medicine. We've been talking about spinal muscular atrophy and other genetic diseases. He's got some advice for mums and dads.
For any couple, sit down either with a GP or with their obstetrician and talk about the plans for pregnancy. There are a number of things that you can look into, adjusting, checking early, so you can avoid surprises later on. And you can start from simple things like kind of changing your diet and being on folic acid, making sure that you're on top of your pap smear, checking your sugars, your thyroid function, if this is needed or if you have a relative history, and going all the way to more specialized things if they're needed based on your history.
Thank you, Dr. George. And if you missed my chat with Dr. George and Mohammed, whose four-month-old baby, Malak, desperately needs a life-saving injection, it will be up on the Dubai Eye website and wherever you get your podcasts.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Very excited and a little bit nervous about our next guest, because today we are meeting an extraordinarily talented young girl who's been recognised as a world record holder three times because of her knowledge of capital cities. Sarah Shipper is 10 years of age and successfully named the capital cities of 195 countries in a world record virtual event and was recently congratulated in person by the Consul General of India. She's joining us on Microsoft Teams now. Sarah, how are you? Congratulations.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much. I am Sarah Chipa, the world record holder on memorizing 195 countries with the capitals in their currencies.
Oh, and the currencies as well. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Well, I was just talking about you this morning with Tom Urquhart from Business Breakfast, and he was saying his son is really good at knowing the flags because of playing computer games. So I just want to say, it's an incredible achievement. You've been recognised by the OMG Book of World Records, International Book of Records, and recently awarded and included in the World Book of Records in London. And how long did it take you to remember, recognise, and really kind of learn 195 countries and their currencies with capital cities? What work went into this?
It went about 50 hours of work or even more. Like, it is a feeling that I don't think I will be able to express, because I am shocked that I've actually made it. And all those 195, and they are not just a couple of words. They are about 825 words. And just remembering them as a 10-year-old kid is like, oh my God, she has done it. Wow. So I would say it's beyond.
Tell us why.
Unimaginable.
Why did you choose this world record? Do you have a love of geography?
Yes, you can say. Now, I love SST. Now, this record was not just an ordinary record, because there was no such record as before which was done, like the country's capitals and their currencies. And this record was very, very different. So I started this record last year during the summer holidays. And yes, it was absolutely amazing. So my journey started around after a couple of days of my summer camp. So I had joined a summer camp which was about learning about different memory techniques, then how to identify different things. So that was like the summer camp that I joined. Then after a few couple months, I did one-to-one sessions with my mentor, and then he said, why not prepare me for a world record? And he had identified that I was able to do many, many things. So he said, why not just prepare her for a world record? And from that day, I was shook that a world record. Now, I didn't even know the meaning of a world record, right? I was so silly at that time. I didn't even know the meaning. And then I still wanted to try it because I'm a person who loves to explore different things. And the best thing about me is that I love to travel. And that is why I decided to do this world record.
Oh, now, I need your tips because we are going to be quizzing each other. I am onto a proper loser here in about 10 minutes. When you said you went to a memory camp and you were learning some tips for improving your memory and remembering certain things, can you share some of that advice for anyone that's listening today?
Yeah, sure. So I have two of my favorite techniques that I really love to use whenever I'm memorizing anything, whether it's related to my academics or anything that I want to learn.
Oh no! Talk about a cliffhanger. We've lost Sara. Right, we're gonna have to get it. Do you know what? I think that might be her trying to throw me off the scent here. I think this might be her trying to, you know, see that I'm a real threat with my geography knowledge, of which I have minimal. We'll get Sara back very, very soon. We are going to be quizzing each other on capital cities, me versus a 10-year-old. So genuinely curious how that's going to go down.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Speaking today to Sara Chipper, she's just 10 years old and has successfully named the capital cities of 195 countries in a world record virtual event. She's a three-time world record holder. And Sara, we had a bit of a cliffhanger because I was asking you to tell us some of your favourite memory techniques. You went to a camp last year that taught you how to memorise things perhaps a bit more easily than you had been able to do before. So for anyone who's perhaps revising for an exam or they've got a presentation coming up, what are some of the techniques that you've learned that you can share with us today?
So these are my two favourite techniques, where the first one is called the funny story. And the second is called look around yourself. So the funny story, as you can hear by the name, it's by whatever you want to memorize, whatever you want to learn, just make a funny story out of it. Like, I've made a world record on the country's capitals and currencies. And this technique has helped me a lot. Let's take maybe China for an example. So China, Beijing, Chinese yuan. So now this is the country China, the capital is Beijing, and the currency is Chinese yuan. So now how do you memorize this and how do you just keep on getting to it once you are asked? What you can do is just make like a funny story out of it. Like, I went to China and I had a popular Chinese ice cream, which was for about 10 Chinese yuan. And this Chinese ice cream is only available in Beijing. So something like this, a funny story which makes you laugh, which makes your family laugh, it can help you to memorize better. You know, I love this technique because it gives you the sense of humor. It helps you to laugh. Like, some people, they laugh on different funny memes, right? It's something like that, but which has a story. The second technique, look around you, which means that whatever you, again, want to memorize, just look around yourself and whatever the things you find. Like for me, I have a bottle on the left of my side. So now I want to memorize something. So now I have a bottle on the left. So now connect it with something like, oh, bottle. So I get this bottle for about 10 bucks and it's a black in color, something like that. And it can help you to memorize. And these are the two techniques that I use throughout my journey while memorizing 195 countries with the capitals and their currencies.
I needed you this morning to share these tips because I've been trying to revise today and it has not been going well. Now, what I would like to point out is that when I was at school, we did have geography, of course, and I got a B at GCSE, which was a pretty decent score. But we didn't learn capital cities. It was a lot about erosion and colouring in coastlines. This is genuinely what I remember. It's just a bit intimidating, the thought of going head to head with a world record holder. You are just 10, but you're so mature. You're so confident. I absolutely love it, Sara. I'm kind of curious what your plans are. What have you got a thought about, even what you're going to study? Are you going to go to university? Have you even thought about a job?
Not yet. So now I have many things in my head, and you cannot decide what you want, right? Like, suppose, like, when you were small, you didn't know that you would be an RJ. So we'll see what happens in the future. That's what my friends always say. What do you want to become? My friends are like, I want to become this. And then they're like, what about you? So then I would say, whatever happens in the future, it would obviously be good for me. So
it's love that.
What the future decides.
I love that. Can you tell I'm stalling for time? Because I really don't want to do this quiz. My last question to you, though, I know traveling's a bit of a problem right now, and you've learned a huge amount about countries, cities, currencies. If you could travel anywhere, if I could click my fingers and you'd be in any country in the world, Sarah, where would you like to go?
I would love to go to Maldives. It's like my favorite place. Tons of islands mixed together, and it's so beautiful, the ocean color. It's like teal, and different islands at different spots, and it's so beautiful.
What is the capital of the Maldives, Sarah?
It's Male.
Yes. All right. I'm just warming you up. I'm just warming you up because the time has come for us to go head to head. Now, I've got a list of 30 countries and you're going to name as many as you can in 30 seconds. You have a list and I'm going to be doing the same. So I will start with my list. I'm going to hit the timer. Zina here is going to be keeping score. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Let's go. What is the capital of Albania?
Tehran.
Algeria.
Algiers.
Andorra.
Andorra la Vella.
Barbados.
Bridgetown.
Belarus.
Minsk.
Bhutan.
Thimphu.
Bolivia.
La Paz.
Equatorial Guinea.
Malibu.
Okay. Okay. Oh, Zina, I can tell you, she got every single one correct. Every single one. Zina's going to count it out. Okay, it's the part of the day that she got eight. Eight in 30 seconds. Okay. Now, I'm so nervous. I really don't want to do this.
Can I say one thing?
Of course.
So when I'm asking you, can I mix the order?
Yeah, you can. That's fine. Yes. I just said to Zina, do you think she'll ask me in alphabetical order? And she's like, yeah, probably. Uh-oh. Okay. Oh, God. This is Helen Farmer checking in for humiliation duty live on Dubai I-103.8, tested by a 10-year-old on my... Can you pick the easy ones? Can we go Europe that I might have actually been to? Right. I'm ready if you're ready. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to hit the timer. I feel sick. Okay. Let's go. Go.
China.
Beijing.
Colombia.
Pass. No, Bogota.
Okay, correct. Kazakhstan.
It begins with, I don't know, pass. Okay. Oh, no, it's Nur-Sultan.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Japan.
Tokyo.
Finland.
Helsinki.
Latvia.
Pass. Zina, what was my score?
Lebanon.
Thank you. I got five. I don't think that was too horrendous. I think with a few 50 hours of practice using your technique, Sarah, I think I might be in the running to maybe take on a 10-year-old for the 2022 world record. Sarah, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've had so many messages saying how incredible you are, what a fan people are of you. And I think it's just wonderful to hear someone who is just really enjoying the love of learning. And now you've got some pretty serious credentials to your name. Massive congrats to you. What are your plans for the summer? More memory camp, or what are you going to do?
Mostly exploring more Dubai, because I came to Dubai when I was 1 year old. And yes, I've been to like almost every place in Dubai, and I want to go there again and do some more preparation for another surprise coming up.
That's what I was going to ask you. I bet you're working on another world record. I won't ask you to reveal it now, but will you tell us when you're ready?
Yep.
Brilliant.
Yes, I will.
Thank you, Sarah Sheeper, joining us. 10-year-old, thrice world record holder who just trounced me in a capital city quiz. Congratulations. We are family.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon. Now, no one relishes failure, least of all children, for whom getting medals and winning places, and even if it's a simple board game, can feel like life or death. But there's a huge amount that can be learned through failure. And yeah. What we're talking about this afternoon with Claire Turnbull is how to fail and how to learn from it. Claire Turnbull is the head of prep at the Royal Grammar School, Guildford in Dubai, opening next term. Claire, you're opening next term. It's going to be hugely exciting. Congratulations in advance. How are the last minute bits of preparation going?
Oh, Helen, it's lovely to be here. Thank you. Yeah, they're going really well. We had a real moment last week where we moved into the school building. We're 7 weeks ahead of schedule. Really exciting. But, you know, a school is not a building. A school's all about the children, and we can't wait for them to join us in August. So not long now. I'm on that final countdown to being back into a proper school.
Oh, well, huge exciting time. And as I said, no one loves the idea of failing, of not being on the podium, of not achieving the goals they set out to achieve. And we've had a lot of this in our house, namely because for a while, racing our children to say, right, first one to the bedroom to get ready was hugely effective. And then it wasn't when they'd be crying before 7 a.m. because they lost the race from the front door to the bedroom door. I've been trying to encourage my husband to stop the competitive thing because I can't cope with picking up the pieces. But whether it is, you know, a four-year-old or a 44-year-old, I think what we need to try and remember, even if we are having a tough time of it, is that through failure, we kind of learn how to succeed better. We become more resilient. But how on earth can we apply that logic to a child? And it's something that you at the school are looking to build into your curriculum and really give them a toolkit that allows them to have skills to thrive in a world that is unpredictable, it's uncertain, and the only thing, you know, the only thing constant is change. So how on earth do you even begin in a school to introduce the concept of failure and why it can be a positive?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really great question. And I think it's something that all of us have struggled so much with. You know, Dubai, but everywhere is a very aspirational place, and we want to be the best and we want our children to be the best. But actually, you know, being really clear with them about what we call the learning pit, and that's a classic word that's used in growth mindset, where actually our best learning comes in that uncomfortable place where we're struggling, we're potentially failing, and we can then really truly reflect on how we're doing and become better. It's so effective, but we are not great at modelling this as adults. We're great at telling people it's okay to make mistakes. But you know what? In most families, in most workplaces, you want to be the best. And so we make our mistakes in private often as adults. And something I really encourage my fellow practitioners to do is model making mistakes. And model the emotional reaction of feeling cross with yourself. It's fine to be cross with yourself. How we express it and what we do when we're cross, of course, needs to be appropriate. But actually, we should never not be emotional. Emotions are good. They shouldn't be shied away from. But it's about saying it's how we work through that emotion and we get to a point of perseverance or of learning. That's what's really, really important for our young people, to know that it's okay. Instead of mummy feeling upset in the kitchen, you know, or in the garden or wherever, to have that quiet space. Don't be afraid to say to the children, you know, actually, I'm really cross with myself right now. I made that mistake, but give me a minute. I'm just going to work myself through it. And look, actually, I can sort this out.
Now, not to blow my own trumpet, but I've spoken about this before. I am an excellent parallel parker. But something I do on occasion is sometimes get it a little bit wrong on purpose and say to children, oh, oops, didn't get it right the first time. And I know that sounds like a really minor example, but I think you're right. I think kids see us adults as these, you know, infallible beings who never make mistakes.
Yeah.
And there's a huge amount of danger in that, because when they do make a mistake themselves, it feels like a massive failing. I've got to be honest, I think distance learning has played a big part in that, because when the children are in a classroom setting, they see their friends putting their hands up to try and get an answer right or contribute an idea. And sometimes it's not the right answer. It's not the most suitable answer. Whereas on distance learning, our poor kids didn't see anyone else trying and so-called failing. Yeah. They just felt themselves not getting it right the first time. And that was really disheartening. I mean, and my kids especially found it really, really difficult. I mean, that's my only example, obviously, but
yeah,
they didn't see anyone else trying, not getting it right. They just felt that they were the only ones failing.
Absolutely. And I think this is why aren't we all so grateful that we're back in school in an environment where those subliminal messages and learning, which are so important to our children's development, happen day in, day out. Back in the Royal Grammar School in Guildford, teachers would email me and say, Claire, don't worry. I do know that I've made a mistake on the whiteboard. I'm modelling it, because, again, there was that fear of, don't judge me. I do know what I'm doing. But it was about actively giving permission to do that. So I think it's great what you're doing with the parallel parking. We all need to do it. But we then need to watch our language when a child does make a mistake.
Do we then
jump straight in and try and fix it? That classic one, isn't it? Your child comes home and they weren't learning their spellings all week. And, they got them all right in the car on the way to school. And you pick them up and you say, well, how did it go then? And they say, oh, it was all right. I got 9 out of 10. And do we say, well, that's amazing, fantastic, great job? Or do we say, wow, that's amazing, fantastic, great job, which one did you get wrong? We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Fantastic to have you with us this Sunday afternoon. And be honest, when your kid scores 9 out of 10 in a quiz, do you say, great job, or do you say, which one did you get wrong? We're talking about the importance of failure and learning from your mistakes with Claire Turnbull. She's the head of prep at the Royal Grammar School Guildford here in Dubai.
People always used to warn me about tiger parents. I love tiger parents. I love all parents. But the ones that I challenge the most are sweeper parents. Think about the Scottish sport of curling. And the sweeper parents just want, unintentionally, to make their children's lives as easy as possible and as smooth as possible. And as a result, these poor children, and I've taught children in the past like it, we probably all know, who've never come up against a problem. And so, everything is fixed for them because we want the best for our children. Actually, that's not the best, is it? Because they can't deal with that. I don't know what to do. How do I deal with this?
Do you know, I've heard of a similar concept, which is kind of snowplow parents, which is trying to move anything uncomfortable out of the way, make sure our little precious ones never have any discomfort, any problems, any obstacles. And I know it comes from, and I've definitely done that before, because we want our children to be happy. We want things to be easy for them. We don't want to be dealing with tantrums and tears and discomfort. But we're not doing them any favours in the long run. But in the moment, I get it. I 100% get it, because it's hard to see them struggle or get something wrong or not get a place on the podium, a medal or whatever that might be. But ultimately, is it teaching that growth mindset? For anyone who's not heard the phrase growth mindset before, Claire, how do you explain it?
Oh, well, so growth mindset, very much psychology I have to say, I think it is out here very much in Dubai, in the schools I've seen it, of developing that can-do attitude. So a classic phrase is not, I can't do it, but I can't do it yet. And it's okay not to be able to do it yet, but I'm going to try and get the skills to do it, or I'm going to persevere to do it. And, the 21st century learning habits, they're pivotal to us here at RGS, and I know to many other great schools, of having aspiration, reflection, perseverance, engagement, children learning how to learn. And this isn't this mystical thing that just happens, but allowing children to have a real structure of how to learn and how to cope with failure or uncertainty. Because let's face it, poor children and us all, we've had to cope with so much uncertainty, haven't we, over the last 18 months. And that will continue. So it's to say, yeah, okay, I don't quite know what's going to happen, but I do know this. And this is enough of a foundation to mean that I'm going to be okay for tomorrow. I'm going to be okay for next week, because actually I do know this. And the competition bit, I would always encourage and try wherever it's possible that we do, where was I yesterday? Am I in a better place today? Have I made progress? Mm-hmm. If I have, that be competitive with myself, not always with others.
Oh, I like that. And I say that as someone who had a game of noughts and crosses, tic-tac-toe with my daughter last week. And it ended in the most spectacular teenage tantrum from a six-year-old. We're talking door slamming. I want to be alone. Leave me alone. I can't believe you won, et cetera, et cetera. And I spoke to a friend about it who's got slightly older children. She's like, yeah, you just need to keep playing. Or something like Snakes and Ladders, where that is part of the game, is going down the snake. But my goodness, some very big feelings and very small bodies going on right now. And every parent I speak to is really having a tough time of it. So normalizing, as you say, that competitive spirit, but with themselves rather than, well, ideally with mummy. Now, one thing I'd like to play now is a clip from a... Listen, screen time has gone through the roof in our household, but there is such a thing as some good screen time. Claire, thank you so much for sharing your insights today, what you're doing through the curriculum at the Royal Grammar School, Guildford, Dubai, and what you're going to be doing from September as well. Really appreciate your time today, and all the very best with the last bits of preparation before you open your doors in September.
Thank you very much, and all the best to you and to all the parents who are going to have a wonderful summer, I'm sure, with their children.
Let's hope so. Lots of snakes and ladders.
Absolutely. Good call.
Take care. So what are you, a tiger parent or a sweeper parent?
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.